had only known the communities of the people when I was working with them on a set, not realizing that as all actors together, we have a community within our union.
Why do we need a union? That question suggests that workers unionizing in any workplace require an excuse. This is a right that workers have the right to exercise, and they shouldn't have to have any particular reason to do it other than that they can.
From day one, he was talking with our members and was trying to help us work with the company to settle the lockout, was on our side. He was at the rallies we did, gave, you know, great speech at City Hall in support of our members. And that's really the kind of labor guy who you want to be going in to lead the Department of Labor.
I don't really try to be as innovative as I probably could, because I would feel that if someone walked in, it might be seen as a waste of time, or that if it failed, well, that just wasted a whole day of class.
It's kind of an example of how it should go versus how it does go in this country for organizing.
People turn and walk away from their trade not knowing how to look for work, for starters, not knowing what direction to go to get services, or if they're even available.
Our parents kind of grew up in the whole mindset of, you know, you show up to work, you work hard, boss will take care of you.
Yeah, you'll get a nice pension.
You know, the boss shits gold, you know, and as long as you're good to him, he'll be good to you, you'll get a nice pension.
A lot of those people
during the bubble, back in 2009 when everything crashed, a lot of those guys lost their pensions.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, former Beverly Hills 90210 star Gabrielle Carteris talks with America's Workforce Union podcast about how she got involved in her union, SAG-AFTRA, where she's now president. On the Working People podcast, we hear about how staff at the American Civil Liberties Union are the latest nonprofit employees to organize a union. Steelworkers in Boston know which side Labor Secretary nominee Marty Walsh is on. We'll hear about it on their Solidarity Works podcast. Our mini theme this week is Voices of Workers. On the Educating from the Heart podcast, we hear from an anonymous teacher about the culture of fear and intimidation in Florida schools. The BCTGM Voices Project, the podcast from the Bakers Union, talks with International Rep Lisa Gregory about growing up union holding office at Local 58G, and what she's learned about organizing and negotiating along the way. On Grit Northwest, a Carpenters podcast, we meet Penny Painter, the Supportive Services Coordinator for Construction Industry Apprentices in the state of Oregon. And the Unify podcast visits with Bradley Parker, a young IBEW Local 105 member from Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada. Finally, we lost two giants of the labor movement this week. Former AFL-CIO President John Sweeney and labor folk singer and activist Ann Feeney will have a special edition of the weekly out tomorrow honoring their memories. Keep an ear out for it. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker. Here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Right now, let's go to line number two and welcome Gabrielle Carteris. Gabrielle is president of the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of TV Radio Artists, my union. You may recall a very, very popular TV show going back to the 90s. She played Andrea Zuckerman on Beverly Hills 90210. And she went on to perform in a number of TV series and movies. Some of them included Touched by an Angel, King of the Hill, NYPD Blue, JAG, Criminal Minds, just to name a few. Talk to me about getting involved in the union. I know when you got involved with all the shows and all that, you became a union member. That's how it works. But getting involved in the union, talk to me about that part. How did that materialize?
So about 14 years ago, I was on a set shooting a film, and I was in a fight scene, and I became partially paralyzed. And had to stop working, and I came home, and I started really interfacing with the union because I needed support. And then I was asked, members had asked me if I wanted to come to sit into the after boardroom, and I was like, what is that? And I started in that moment of really getting involved and then recognizing the benefit of a community, because I had only known the communities of the people when I was working with them on a set, not realizing that, you know, as all actors together, we have a community within our union. And then starting to see the issues that members face were the very issues that I was facing, and that the power really was coming, that even I had in that moment when I was injured, it came out of the collective voice that gave me the support I needed. And really recognizing as I started to really participate, wow, you know, the real differences that are made, the things that we could accomplish, it happens through members really committing to do the work, and that's what makes the union strong. And I sound so kind of Pollyannish, but it's true, and it's so embedded in me in a way as I've gone through these years, and we went to merge the unions and working with members and the issues that we're being faced with, that I've really had a real sense of what it is to be a part of this union and working with members. It's an incredible honor. I really support anybody who's in a union to reach out and really participate in their union.
Well, Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us here on America's Workforce. And I have to say one more thing. I was reading in your bio that you were 29 when you were doing Beverly Hills 90210, and you were portraying a 15-year-old. I was just wondering. Okay, I'm 67. You think I can portray maybe a 29 or a 35-year-old? What do you think?
Absolutely. Look, I'm 150 now, and I still look like I can go and be 40. So yeah, go ahead. For sure.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for joining us here. I'm going to drive everybody to the website. It's sagaftra.org, sagaftra.org. And you could follow them on Twitter. That would be twitter.com/sagaftra. Gabrielle, thank you for joining us here on America's Workforce.
Thank you. You take care.
What a fun lady. Gabrielle Carteris, president of SAG-AFTRA, right here on America's Workforce.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Working People, a podcast about the lives, jobs, dreams, and struggles of the working class today. Brought to you in partnership with In These Times magazine and The Real News Network, produced by Jules Taylor, and supported entirely by listeners like you. My name is Maximilian Alvarez, and we've got a great episode for y'all today. The COVID-19 pandemic has posed many serious and dangerous challenges for workers everywhere. Not just for workers on the job, but for workers trying to exercise their right to organize. And if working conditions during the pandemic have shown us anything, it's that all workers need and deserve the protection of a union. But there have been some unexpected bright spots on this front over the past year as well, including the boom in unions at nonprofits around the United States. And the Nonprofit Professional Employees Union, or NPEU, has played a major role in that boom, working with rank-and-file workers to organize unions at nonprofits like the Economic Policy Institute, the Scholars Strategy Network, Jews United for Justice, and the National Women's Law Center. So you guys may have heard in the news that staff workers at the American Civil Liberties Union recently voted to form a union and affiliate themselves with the NPEU. I was so grateful to get a chance to talk with Alex Ortiz and Jillian Gannison from ACLU Staff United, as well as Kayla Blado, who is the president of NPEU and a nonprofit worker herself.
Today was our deadline for recognition, so it was a big day, and we heard back from management. Management did not recognize us, per se, but they did say that once we hash out certain concerns they have about our unit, that they're looking forward to a good faith process moving forward. So that's where we're at now.
ACLU management's message, they said all the things that one would expect a nonprofit of ACLU's stature and history supporting workers' rights would say. You know, they paid lip service to supporting workers' rights, including their own, to organize a union, but ultimately they declined to take the basic step that we asked them to take and recognize the union given the overwhelming majority that we have in support. So instead, they pushed back on that, and we're not there yet, but we're hoping that we have a constructive dialogue with them going forward and that we sort this out sooner rather than later. And we're hoping that they don't deploy a delaying tactic, as I've seen many times from my experience at the NLRB, from employers seeking to avoid unions and seeking to bust unions. So I'm hoping that's not what's going to happen here.
The workers of ACLU Staff United have a supermajority of cards signed, and they have a really enthusiastic group of folks who want a union as quickly as possible. And we hope that management does the right thing and voluntarily recognizes the union and doesn't keep pushing for a tactic that's just going to further delay the union, like a private ballot election.
And I'll just add, if I may, we know that ACLU management has hired a particular law firm that I'm familiar with from my experience at the Manhattan office of the National Labor Relations Board. That's the agency that enforces the law under which we're organizing, the National Labor Relations Act. And that firm is in the business of representing employers who want to oppose their workers unionizing. So I was dismayed to learn when they had retained this law firm, but I'm hoping that it's not a signal of where things will lead, but we'll see.
Yeah, I guess we will.
So the ACLU, and if you go to the ACLU's website today, there's a long write-up on the ACLU's support of workers' organizational rights, where they specifically talk about how it is one way workers acting collectively where individual rights can be more freely exercised, right? So the promotion of collective rights can help individual rights find their full birth and actually be expressed fully. So that's some of the things that the ACLU does do, and we're hoping that they continue to do in their dealings with the its own staff trying to unionize. Now, why a union at the ACLU? Why do we need a union? That question, in my mind, suggests that the effort of workers unionizing in any workplace require an excuse or something. I mean, this is a right that workers private sector across the country, in most industries, have the right to use, to exercise. So they should be celebrated, and they shouldn't have to have any particular reason to do it other than that they can. One of the core reasons that workers generally want to unionize that's clear here, although you ask any ACLU employee why he or her, they want a particular, want a union, they're going to give different reasons, right? By and large, about that suggest with their particular circumstances at their job. But more broadly speaking, it's having a voice in one's working conditions, right? And being able to have some influence in promoting workplace democracy and having the decisions that affect your day-to-day life to have some say in that. And that is a reason, in my view, that the ACLU and other employers should welcome the effort of their staff to unionize.
For the first Solidarity Works episode of 2021, we're going to talk about some of the new cabinet members under President Joe Biden's administration, the departments they head, and what the union is hoping to see come out of their 4 years of service. So I am now here with Anna Finley, the USW State and Regulatory Policy Director based in DC. A big one for labor and for workers is the Secretary of Labor. And I feel like that was the one the unions in general waiting to hear on for a while about who Biden was going to pick. And on January 7th, he announced he was nominating Boston Mayor Marty Walsh for the position. One of his first major tasks, of course, will be coordinating states' payments of extended unemployment insurance amidst this pandemic. So we know that's at least one thing he will be doing. But what else does the Labor Secretary do, and what impact does it have, not just on the labor movement, but on individual workers?
The Secretary of Labor is one of the most important jobs for individual workers and the labor movement as a whole. They do the things that everyone thinks about, right? The Department of Labor oversees making sure that people are paid a fair legal wage. They deal with employment discrimination. They deal with whistleblower complaints. But a couple things worth mentioning that are really important to steelworker members is the Secretary of Labor oversees both OSHA and MSHA, so the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and the Mine Safety and Health Administration. Those are, of course, really important to our union, really important to our members. And we have great leadership going into those agencies in particular, but it's always good to have a strong labor ally like Marty Walsh overseeing that and making sure that they push the most worker-friendly policy forward. The other really important job that the Secretary of Labor has is overseeing a little part of the Department of Labor called the Bureau of International Labor Affairs. And that office does things like tries to prevent child labor around the world, but they also enforce labor standards in the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. So that's going to be really important in making sure that agreement is implemented correctly and making sure that we're really raising labor standards in Mexico.
Well, I guess that's interesting to know that they run OSHA and MSHA, and obviously we work a lot with them and do a lot of lobbying there. Is there anything that we're hoping Walsh does, especially in the realm of health and safety?
Yeah, I think many of our members are familiar with these fights that we've had for a long time. I think other fights are also ones that we have worked on for a long time. Our members in healthcare certainly suffer a horrible amount of violence on the job, so we'll be, again, pushing for a standard to prevent violence in the workplace against healthcare workers. And then at MSHA, we'll be looking at a number of things, but one of them being a silica standard, because as many of our folks know, we finished a silica standard at OSHA to protect our workers there. But of course, members who are in mines are not protected from silica in the same way.
Great. Was there anything
about Walsh's background that maybe is making us optimistic? Is there anything that we're... Because I actually didn't know anything about him. Horrible for me. I was like, oh yeah, Boston has a mayor. But is there anything about his background that I guess makes us optimistic about the fights ahead?
Yeah. Mayor Walsh has been a really great fan and friend to our union in the Boston area. I think it's really telling and important to tell the story about how he stood with our union when our members at National Grid were locked out. From day one, he was talking with our members and was trying to help us work with the company to settle the lockout, was on our side. He was at the rallies we did, gave, you know, great speech at City Hall in support of our members. And that's really the kind of labor guy who you want to be going in to lead the Department of Labor, which is the department for workers and to protect workers. And we don't often see someone with those, you know, true labor credentials who comes out of a union who to be nominated to lead that department. So I think it's really exciting. He certainly knows our union. He knows our members in Boston. He's been helpful to us. And so I think this is an exciting time, and we have reason to be really optimistic about the work that's going to happen at the Department of Labor if he's confirmed by the Senate.
And he's certainly a far cry from the last person we had in that position. So
yeah,
hopefully that makes a difference. Make sure to check out usw.to/podcast for more episodes of Solidarity Works. Until next time, take care and stay safe, siblings.
Educating from the heart. Thank you for joining our lively conversations with teachers, support professionals, parents, and students as they share issues that matter most in our public schools. Here are your hosts, Tina Dunbar and Luke Flint.
Thank you for joining us on Educating from the Heart. On this episode, we'll talk about job security, or the lack of it, for Florida teachers. We'll also explore why educators have given the state a failing grade for its vaccine distribution. Welcome back. I'm Tina Dunbar with my co-host, Luke Flint. Hi, Luke. Happy first episode for 2021.
Happy 2021, Tina. You know, I don't think a lot of people understand how perilous it is to be a teacher in Florida right now. We're one of only three states in the country where teachers do not have due process. That means they serve as at-will employees, and at the end of the school year, their contract can be non-renewed for any reason, or as happens all too often, non-renewed for no reason at all.
Luke, let's name it. Senate Bill 736, the Student Success Act. It was the very first bill that Governor Rick Scott signed into law in 2011. It has drastically changed the landscape for teachers. One element of the law that has devastated the teaching force has been the stripping away of the ability for teachers to earn a multi-year renewable employment agreement known as a professional services contract, or PSC. Now, I want to be clear, we're not talking about tenure here. Also consider lifelong job protections, because that never existed for Florida's K-12 teachers.
Exactly. But what PSC did do is it ensured job stability and due process before a teacher could be terminated. And they had to earn their PSC status, and that's a key word. It took many years and many observations by a principal before someone could earn the right to have their PSC. It makes you wonder why Governor Scott and the Florida GOP were so interested in eliminating these job protections, which again can be non-renewed without cause, not even giving a teacher the opportunity to improve.
If you remember, the rhetoric back when this law was being debated was bizarre. Lawmakers said eliminating job security would help with recruitment and retention. It didn't make sense to me then, and now we have the evidence. It has created a culture of fear, intimidation, and increased instability in districts statewide. In fact, our first guest is an annual contract teacher who has asked to remain anonymous out of fear of retaliation. She's a certified teacher who has taught in Florida for several years and hopes to continue her career here.
You can do a really good job. I feel like a lot of annual contractor teachers I've talked to feel like they can do a really good job and do everything right. But then, you know, we all make mistakes and teachers can't be perfect. So I think it's living with that fear that that little mistake that you made in, you know, September might be the reason that you don't get asked to come back the next year, that you don't get your renewal on your contract. So I live in a little bit of fear that I'm not going to have a job the next year. And a lot of times we don't find out until April or even May. So then really there's a lot of fear about trying to find another position quickly. It's just something I constantly have in the back of my head thinking about. And I think it pushes me to, again, want to be perfect. I don't feel like I can at all ever take any small kind of break. Everything has to be on all the time because I'm so concerned about not getting my contract renewed. It's exhausting. It is the mental hoops that I jump through all the time in my brain. It just makes me really tired. And I don't really try to be as innovative as I probably could because I would feel that if someone walked in, it might be seen as a waste of time, or that if it failed, that just wasted a whole day of class. And that just, I just feel like there's a constant tally mark above my head that tallies up all of the mistakes that I make throughout my teaching year. And that once you get to a certain mark, you're done, find another job. And in reality, it's more complex than that, but it does feel that way a lot of times. And not just to myself, I have a group of annual contract teachers that we all came in at the same time at my school and another school. And we all feel that way. It's taken a mental toll on just who I am as a teacher.
I've heard some annual contract or AC teachers express concerns about talking with administrators about specific student needs. All educators should feel free to advocate for their students. Do teachers need due process when standing up for themselves and their students?
I won't say that I feel completely silenced, but it does add another layer, a weight that comes with knowing that you feel strongly enough that you should go talk to your principal or another administrator about advocating for your students in your classroom, but knowing that maybe it's not going to be received in the best way. There's kind of that weight of what if this makes them view me badly? I don't know if maybe I should just keep silent. Maybe I'll just wait and see if it gets better. And I have found myself pushing a lot of things to the side because I don't want to be either that teacher that's annoying, that's always in their office. And I don't want to be that because I don't want to be seen as a nuisance, because who wants to keep around the teacher that's annoying or a nuisance? But also I don't want to be the difficult teacher. I think that's kind of what it does too, being on annual contract. You want to avoid labels. If you're going to give me a label, then I hope it's that I'm the workhorse, not that I am the trouble teacher.
This is Luke. And I'm wondering if you could maybe provide a specific instance or two, if you can think of one, of something where you have had that internal struggles, a situation where you knew you needed to advocate, but there was also that fear of maybe not wanting, as you said, to get on the principal's bad side or to be labeled as a complainer.
Yes. Yeah, I can think of one specifically. And it's not just at my school. I think it's a countywide policy that's developing, which is the idea of giving the 50s versus the zeros. So even if a student doesn't turn in anything, still giving them a 50. Or if they do one thing on that, like write their name, giving them a 50, which started in elementary school and is working its way up through middle and some of high school. And I was among the teachers that wanted to push back on that, but I never did because I felt like I wasn't in a secure enough place to say anything, even though I felt strongly about them getting credit for not doing any work, that wasn't going to help them in the long run. I thought I knew what was best for my students, and I felt strongly about something, but I still sat back and didn't say anything, even though other teachers did. They said plenty. I did not join in on that because I felt like I was in a more rocky, precarious situation than they were.
I understand. Thank you so much for your honesty. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. Join us for our next episode. Until you tune in again, keep educating from the heart.
Welcome to the BCTGM Voices Project, a podcast highlighting the real people who make up our union, the bakery, confectionery, tobacco workers, and grain millers. I'm Michelle Ellis, Director of Digital Media. I will bring the work of our union to you through monthly interviews with the BCTGM's hardworking leaders, organizers, and everyday members. This is the BCTGM Voices Project. For this episode, I had the privilege of getting to know one of our newest international representatives, Lisa Gregory. Lisa has only been with our union for 5 or 6 years. She started as a rank and file member at J.M. Smucker in Toledo, Ohio, and worked her way up pretty quickly from there. I was very interested in her story, as she is someone who represents the power of women within our union. She has a tremendous respect for unionism as a concept, and she'll talk about the long history inside of her own family of union membership. And she's fostered a real sense of purpose with the leadership roles that she has taken on within the BCTGM. Lisa currently serves local unions in the East Central region of the U.S., but I really look forward to seeing how her future plays out here, as she is truly passionate about making a difference for working people. Here is Lisa Gregory.
So Lisa, the short bio that Karina published in the news last year, and I noticed that you were previously with UAW, and then that you weren't with us very long. So there has to be a passion there, and I was curious if there was like a family background or...
Yeah, my passion is definitely driven from being from a union family and a very extensive line. My grandpa, two great uncles, my dad was a 30-year UAW welder, three uncles, one aunt, three cousins, and now me.
Wow.
Yeah, a very extensive line. I take a lot of pride in that. And I think that that gives me the passion in the job that I'm in now. You know, I understand what this means. I understand the impact that I can have in this position and what it means to have a better life, quality of life. I had a great union upbringing. Couldn't be more proud of it. And I thank my dad for that too. I started the same facility that he did in 1999. And I know that I couldn't have done that without him.
Okay. And that was a UAW?
Yep. That was UAW Local 696 in Dayton.
Got it.
Yep.
You were involved a lot in the organizing campaigns at Danone and then Macomb last year. Will you just talk a little bit about what the difference between the two and maybe the things that you learned?
Yeah, for organizing campaigns, actually, those were my first and only two, but I'm glad that those were the ones. They couldn't have been more different. With Danone, it was a much easier, actually, it's an example of how it should go versus how it does go in this country for organizing, and it's a sad reality. But the Danone campaign, there was a neutrality agreement in place with the company, which meant they weren't going to run an anti-union campaign. There wouldn't be union busting consultants. They wouldn't be spreading lies and misinformation and trying to instill fear in people about wanting to organize a union. And that's just all the difference. And above and beyond that, they supplied a trailer in their we were able to put up a trailer in their parking lot to answer questions from employees. They said they could come in during their shift, before and after work. We were out of the elements, which is important in central Pennsylvania in the winter. We had a cookout in the parking lot. They gave us access to a bathroom in the plant. It's just unreal. And it really made all the difference in that campaign. And then you turn the page to Hearthside, which this is the third attempt, I believe, in 20 years. And they run a very strong anti-union campaign. from day one. The union busting consultants were in there 24/7, bilingual, to reach out to all the groups in the plant and scare them to death. They use the worst of the worst tactics for undocumented workers. If you vote for a union, you'll be deported, which is, I just don't know how you sleep at night and say those kinds of things.
Yeah.
We could set up out in front of the plant, but we were exposed to the elements. We were there getting sunburnt in July and freezing and trying to get feeling back in our toes. And it was just a very different experience. They actually put up cement filled barrels to block the public right away and wrap chains around it to where we were setting up, which we couldn't believe.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, they had hired off-duty police officers to monitor us, and it just night and day. And
how do you stay in it when that is going on? How many organizers were there on a regular basis, first of all?
We had a crew that kind of would change in and out, but Margaret McLaughlin was there from day one, and long days, and shout out to Margaret, fantastic job. And we had a group of four or five rank and file that came in to help us, Kenita Jones and Jared Cummins and Fernando Sanchez, Jose Falalta, Nate Zeff, and Mark Lee also came out to help. We had a great committee, and it just, you know, we were really close. We tried to keep morale up.
Yeah.
You know, we would get as many of us out in front of the plant as we could, starting sometimes at 4:30 in the morning, all the way until 10, 11 o'clock at night, and just stay out there, be visible, be present, try to let the employees know we were there.
Yeah.
And it was hard. It was hard to keep morale up. It would ebb and flow. Some weeks were tough for everybody mentally.
Yeah.
But then there are weeks that, man, there's just no better job in the world to know that you're trying to help people improve their lives.
Yeah. So, you guys have a Facebook group at Hearthside that I am in. I only see things every once in a while. It was very active during the campaign, of course, and a little bit after the election. But I see some stuff here and there. I'm curious, do you keep in touch with some of the workers that are there? Like, what's happening now?
Yeah, I think that it's important that they know we felt that loss too, and we really did get close to them.
Yeah.
So I do keep in touch with them just to see how it's going. It seems like they've benefited a little bit from the campaign. They've gotten a new plant manager who is a little bit more tolerable.
Okay.
They're changing some managers, which they're happy about. But I want to keep in touch with them and maybe give this another go in a year.
Yeah.
And I want to keep them going in that direction.
Yeah.
I think we can do it. We were close this time. We were very close.
Such a bummer.
It was a bummer.
Thanks again. I know you got stuff going on later today, so I'll let you go and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Welcome to another edition of The Spotlight, a special segment inside the Grit Northwest podcast, where we acknowledge those programs that go above and beyond to lend support to better the lives of our members in the Northwest Carpenters Union. Hi, I'm Joe Cadwell, the writer, producer, and host of this show. Today, we'll meet Penny Painter, the Supportive Services Coordinator for Construction Industry Apprentices in the state of Oregon. During our conversation, we will learn about the various programs Penny oversees and how they are used to offset the financial burdens many apprentices experience while learning their craft. From assistance in purchasing tools and necessary work gear, to helping with living out-of-town expenses and childcare, Penny Painter, welcome to the Spotlight.
Thank you, Joe, for having me. I really appreciate you helping us get the word out about these support services.
And thank you so much for taking your time to be on the show today, Penny. So why don't you tell our listeners something about you and your background?
I'll start with, I'm a carpenter by trade, and I spent about 35, 40 years out there working in the trades. I was a general contractor for 18 years, so I'm well-rounded. And I also worked for training programs like the Oregon Tradeswoman for a little over 5 years. And I worked with the ETAP, Evening Trades Apprenticeship Preparation Program, during that same 5 years, and spent a lot of time training folks and helping people get into the trades.
So to surmise, Penny, I'm looking at some of the information you sent me over earlier, and I wasn't aware that how beneficial these benefits are. I'm looking at fuel assistance for an apprentice up to $1,000, assistance with lodging,
That can go up to $1,500 per apprentice. Meal allowances up to $250. Daycare assistance with a maximum of $10,000 per apprentice. That's just amazing to me. Tools up to tools and PPE up to $600 per apprentice. This is just astounding to me that this program is available to people that are, you know, enrolled in our apprenticeship program.
Absolutely, Joe. And you know what? That's just to start. If they attend a budget class, all those numbers rise. And so, yeah, those values increase with attending the budget class. But you're right. They're really good standard starting values in the first place for the apprentices. It can help somebody out in the very first place for sure.
And as we know, on a national average, regardless of the craft or trade, there's about a 50 to 60% washout of first-year apprentices. And I think a lot of that has to do with just the you know, newness to the particular trade that they're looking at, difficulty shoring up things like childcare or the expenses of living out of town to learn your craft. And so these services seems like they'd be very beneficial to people just getting started.
If they know about this program, I can help them. I can walk them through. I can provide stuff for them. I can help them answer questions or guide them in the right direction in order to get those questions answered. That's one thing that I really want to express here today, too, is that we are here to help. If you just call me and ask me a question, that's okay. The same thing with the training center. People turn and walk away from their trade not knowing how to look for work, for starters. Not knowing what direction to go to get services or if they're even available. Not realizing that you have meetings to bond with other people that are doing the same thing that you're doing. Really super important. You have to get involved to be the change. They run into some kind of a barrier or somebody that says something just stupid and they turn and decide that they want to go a different direction. If they need help with that, then they just need to ask the question and they need to know that there's more of us out here that are willing to help and want them to succeed. And that's what we're here for, is to help them succeed.
Thank you so much for taking your time to be on the show to explain to our listeners all these valuable programs that are available to them when they decide to take on a career in the heavy highway construction trades.
Thank you, Joe.
Hello, and welcome to Unify, a Young Workers podcast, a member of the Labor Radio and Podcast Network. So happy to have you with us again. In this episode, I'm interviewing Bradley Parker from Hamilton, IBW Local 105.
But sometimes in the past, the union hasn't had the best look. You know, a lot of people refer to, you're a lazy union worker.
Right? Oh, I know.
Which I've personally found always be the opposite, but, you know.
I think there's just great people in every trade, yeah. You know, and there's shit people, just like every job out there. Same with union, non-union.
And the other side of it, too, is a lot of people on the outside, they say, oh, well, the unions are there to protect the lazy worker. I know for a fact that on any jobs I've ever been on, if I didn't show up or if I was ever lazy, they're not keeping me. I'm gone.
No.
Like, yeah, you know, you can have the opportunity to start another job down the road, but if you dick around on that job, guess what? You're gone again. So I think that's one of those negative stereotypes that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Actually, unions are making quite the comeback, especially in America.
Yes,
they're starting to get more market share, and it's because of the younger generation.
Yep.
Because, our parents kind of grew up in the whole mindset of, you know, you show up to work, you work hard, boss will take care of you.
Yeah, you don't get a nice pension. The boss.
You know, the boss shits gold, you know, and as long as you're good to him, he'll be good to you. You'll get a nice pension.
Not
and
a,
then
not
a lot of those
anymore.
People during the bubble, back in 2009 when everything crashed.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of guys got kicked out of DeFasco who spent their whole life telling everybody, oh, just, you know, do a good job and stuff like that and you'll be rewarded. And then they got shafted right before their pension was due up. And a lot of those guys lost their pensions.
Completely.
A lot of the younger generation are starting to realize, hey, my parents just lost their shirts. You know, they lost their house. They lost everything. I can't go to school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they kind of are looking to the unions because with the union, you know, you may work for, you know, a certain company for however many years, you could work there your whole life and still be a union member.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, your pension and benefits goes through the local.
Exactly.
And the, as long as the local isn't going anywhere, mm-hmm. as long as right to work stays out of our province,
don't then even we'll be fine. Utter those words.
Yeah. The other thing is the nice thing about the union is that it's the closest you'll ever get to a local grassroots democracy. So that being the sense of, you know, our meetings are closed door mm-hmm. to people outside of the union. But, you know, behind those doors, you know, we follow the Robert's Rules of Order.
Right.
Right. And, you know, all of our officials are elected positions. Yes. They're over certain terms. Everything comes down to a vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you don't like something, you vote against it. Sometimes it passes, sometimes it won't.
Yeah.
Right? But it's because it's a true democracy. Our local is going through a major transition right now.
Okay.
We're kind of, it's not that we're shying away, it's that we're not doing as much steel work.
Yeah.
You know, we're not doing that much heavy industrial.
Good.
We still have a lot. Like we still, like, you know, we have a lot of large contracts going mm-hmm. on, a lot of large jobs at the water treatment plant.
Okay.
Which is, I've been there too. That's a pretty smelly place to work, especially first thing in the morning. And it's just a waft, right? As soon as you walked in. Thankfully, I was on new build.
Oh, yeah.
So the buildings I was in were clean. And
is that
and
why new. Everybody thinks Hamilton smells because of that place?
Because a lot of the smell you get when you come across the Skyway Bridge between like the coke ovens for DeFasco, and then you've got the Burlington Water Treatment Plant right there at the lake, and then you've got the Hamilton.
Everybody, visit Hamilton. It sounds so beautiful.
Yeah, it just worked out that it's just the lowest point, right? The lowest point of the city. You got no choice, right?
Yeah, you're just driving through it. But actually, can I just say, as an outsider, Hamilton is really beautiful. And I think, isn't it like the number... like the largest population of like waterfalls is in Hamilton.
We are the waterfall capital of the world.
Of the world?
Of the world.
I was going to say Canada, but it's of the world. Okay, like.
We've got thousands and thousands of waterfalls.
Wow. My love is strong, you see. I know you'll never get tired of me. Oh, babe. So old.
Was it Cesar Chavez? Maybe it was Dorothy Day. Some will say Dr. King or Gandhi set them on their way. No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see. If you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice?
That's it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We lost two giants of the labor movement this week. Former AFL-CIO President John Sweeney and labor folk singer and activist Ann Feeney will have a special edition of the Weekly out tomorrow honoring their memories. Keep an ear out for it. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Evan Papp, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net and find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Also, check out our weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network's YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. See you next time.
I want to shake your hand. Sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Will you go to jail for justice? Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, yeah.